On this episode of Plant Killers, we'll explore one nation's most notorious fruit and vegetable killer, bad dirt. What makes bad dirt so bad? The answer? The ingredients. But fear not, true crime enthusiasts. This story has a happy ending. New Miracle-Gro Organic raised bed and garden soil. It's made with quality organic ingredients from upcycled green waste like compost and aged bark. Unlike the other guys who can't say the same. Looks like bad dirt's murdering days are over, thanks to Miracle-Gro. Join us next time on Plant Killers.
Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show, live on SiriusXM Channel 111 every weekday at noon East. Hey everyone, I'm Megyn Kelly. Welcome to The Megyn Kelly Show and our weekend special episode where we look back at some of our best content for the past week. We had some great shows this week, including my pal Piers Morgan on to talk about everything from the trial of Donald Trump to Meghan Markle and her new lectures on friendship. Very few know this woman like Piers does. And speaking of guests totally in their comfort zone, Heather McDonald was on this week, and we got into the leftist indoctrination at the center of the campus chaos we are seeing, with anti-Israel college students getting arrested in New York and beyond. We talked about the harassment of Jewish students with the EJs, Emily Jashinsky and Eliana Johnson. And our pals Mike Davis and Dave Ehrenberg were here talking about the latest on Trump, specifically in this New York State Supreme case that he's facing. But we also got into the ridiculous hypocrisy of NBC News when it comes to, quote, checkbook journalism and the use of NDAs, which suddenly those over at NBC find horrifying. Who would use an NDA to silence a woman? Spare me. Not to mention Alec Baldwin's crackhead Barney confrontation. Enjoy, and I'll talk to you on Monday. I've got to ask you about Trump. He's facing four criminal trials. He's got a case being argued before the U.S. Supreme Court right now. He's got the head of the National Enquirer, former David Pecker, on the witness stand right now talking about this deal they struck to cover up for Trump and try to bury bad stories and promote good stories and hit his adversaries with negative stories. First, let me just ask you, because you've spent your life in news. I mean, you've been writing, you know, for newspapers long before most people even knew you on cam. So what do you make of this deal? And would it ever have struck you that this was illegal? This kind of thing is illegal, to accept money from somebody or give money to somebody in order to quash their story or kill it, as the saying goes.
No, look, I ran two of the biggest tabloid newspapers in Britain for 10 years. And this kind of deal in different ways goes on everywhere with all newspapers around the world. You know, if you have a massive star and there's a damaging story about them and they want to suppress that story, then sometimes they'll give you a better one about themselves to kill off the other one. Or, you know, there's always some kind of deal that could be done. When I just realized this would be the first case, Megyn, that was going to come up of the four, because some of them are clearly, I think, more serious and more legitimate and better cases to answer for Trump than others. But this one seems so petty. It seems so trivial. You know, ultimately, it's about whether or not Donald Trump had a one-night stand with a porn star 18 years ago in a Beverly Hills hotel. A, I don't care. I've interviewed Stormy Daniels. You know, she's very plausible when you interview her. But I wasn't in the room. I don't know what really happened. Donald Trump denies it. but either way, I don't care. And I don't think most people care very much. And I think that what's happened here, you've got a clearly politically motivated prosecutor who's a paid-up Democrat. You've got a judge who's obviously a Democrat as well. And they've decided to throw the kitchen sink at Trump by jacking up what should be just a state misdemeanor at worst into some sort of huge seismic federal crime. Well, all the polling I've seen on this shows that most Americans aren't buying this. They don't think that Trump committed a crime here, and they think it's a massive overreach by the prosecution. So I think I heard you at the start, and I totally agree with you. Whatever happens here, you know, A, Trump may get acquitted, because there might be one member of that jury that just goes, you know what, this is ridiculous. And demeaning, frankly, for America to drag a former president of the United States, one of the 45 people who've held this incredibly high office, to drag them through such an unedifying and petty courtroom fiasco for weeks on end, when he should be legitimately allowed to campaign as the nominee for the Republican Party for the next elections. I think there's for all sorts of reasons, this seems to me a ridiculous start to this legal battle against Trump. But whether he wins or loses, you see, I think he either wins because one juror has common sense, or he loses but actually gets martyred in the process. So spectacularly, I watched the scenes this morning going into court with people chanting Trump, 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 and four more years. I don't think this is hurting him. I think it actually, over time, will help him. I think it's martyring Trump. And I think the most right-minded Americans, who are not partisan on the left, but are sort of independent or moderates, will look at this and go, is this really fair? And I always say, I mean, I remember when Bill Clinton was president. And I remember paying Paula Jones $850,000, whatever it was, to pay her off to settle a harassment case. And I remember him having sex with an intern, Monica Lewinsky, in the Oval Office. Both of those things are a lot worse, in my estimation, given he was a serving president when the Monica Lewinsky thing happened, and given he did the payment when he was a serving president to Paula Jones, than anything Trump did in the run-up to an election to basically get rid of a bit of a messy story that probably his biggest concern was not the damage it might do to the election, because I think people factored in Trump and womanizing. It was probably he didn't want Melania to know all about this.
But you know what, Pierce, we've been covering this on the show. This is not well enough understood, including even by us. You know, I have legal panels on all the time. We're all lawyers and we talk about this. The relevant standard is not what was in Trump's head or what his subjective reasons for the payment were. It's the objectively looking at the money. Could said money, in this case, a hush money payment, have ever been used for anything other than to advance a campaign? Is this kind of payment? You look at the nature of the payment. So if it is payment for, I don't know, a podium at a debate, a lectern at a debate stage. Okay, yes, that is something you might only ever buy for a debate, right? Like for a presidential run. But a hush money, everybody pays that. You know, as somebody who's in the tabloids for years, tons of people pay hush money payments. So that's the standard. It's not even what was in Trump's head or whether they get an admission that this was to help his electoral chances. It's irrelevant. Okay, Les, I've got to ask you about this. Speaking of martyrs and people who have been really unfairly put upon, let me ask you about Meghan Markle.
One of the great martyrs of our time.
Poor thing. Her castle was so small. She is apparently getting back into the podcast lane thanks to this far left pro women lemonada company. Richard Eden over in the Daily Mail, your old hot, has a piece today saying they're struggling to get this thing out of the starting blocks. No podcasts are even expected anytime this year and not until 2025. And the podcast, by the way, is going to celebrate the joys of cooking. Or at least something she's doing. Her Netflix show, I guess, is going to celebrate the joys of cooking, gardening, entertaining, and friendship, Piers. She's going to be teaching us how to be a good friend. I can't wait to find out from Meghan Markle what that's like.
Well, it's one of the many friends that she cut off spectacularly the moment she got a bit of royal action, along with her entire family, of course, on both sides, apart from her mother. I don't think Meghan Markle's in any position to be lecturing anybody about friendship. I mean, it always made me laugh at the Archerwell website, their charitable foundation, says it's dedicated to compassion. I mean, it's hard to imagine two people who've been less compassionate in the last few years to the ones around their loved ones than these two. Right, this is two people who trashed all their family, you know, whether it was her father or whether it's Harry's entire family, at a time when Prince Philip and the Queen were both dying. There they were on national television, from Oprah Winfrey to Netflix to whatever, you know, as the Spotify guy put it, whatever grift they could get paid for, up they were trashing their families. So the idea now that they're reduced, or that certainly Meghan Markle is now reduced from somebody who, you know, remember Meghan, she had a fairy tale royal wedding that was seen around the world. You know, the carriages drawn down to Windsor Castle and so on. It was an amazing event. Everyone in this country, I'm in the UK at the moment, everyone loved that marriage when it happened. There was universal support for it, euphoria. It was only their behavior in the first year of their marriage when they began to behave rankly hypocritically, lecturing about poverty whilst having $500,000 baby showers, you know, to lecturing us about the need to watch our carbon footprint and using Elton John and George Clooney's private jets like taxi cabs. And it was the constant hypocrisy that they got picked up on by the media, and then they couldn't handle the criticism from the media, and then it all turned hostile. Then they started suing everybody, and the whole thing got so toxic, eventually they just say, we've had enough of this. We're not going to do any more dreary duties on a wet Wednesday, which is what you have to do to, you know, to earn your royal titles in the estimation of the public. And they decamped off to Montecito, bought themselves a massive mansion. And they were supposed to be doing it, Megan, if you remember, you know, this was going to be their liberation, their freedom, and it was supposed to make them happy. I've never seen two more miserable people who never stop whining and suing absolutely everybody in the pretense that this is because they found their liberation and freedom. If you're so damn happy and free and liberated, well, shut up, stop whining and complaining about everything. But they're obviously not happy. And it's obviously been diminishing returns, where when you trash your family again and again and again, eventually there's not much left to say. And people don't really want to hear it. It's like the Spotify guy said, they're just a pair of grifters who just want to trash their family for loads of money and not put a shift in to do proper work. You and I know how hard it is to do this kind of thing properly. You know, it's a lot of work with a dedicated team, and you put the hours in, and you've got to be creative and high energy and really put graft in. These two wanted to do massive deals with companies and then not do any work. Nobody wants to see her next podcast. Nobody listened to the first one. And that's for this thing she's now doing with the ridiculously long name that no one can remember, where she's going to try and be the new
American, whatever. I have to write it down. American Riviera Orchard, see footnote 47 for the remainder of the name.
Right. And she's now got all her celebrity, you know, sort of B-list, C-list mates putting out Instagram posts about her jam. And it's like, how the mighty fall. This was a woman who had it all in this country, who literally had it all, and is now flogging jam from her kitchen in Montecito while her husband runs around fuming about absolutely everything and everyone, because he knows in his gut, he knows what he's lost. And eventually those chickens will come home to roost.
And then she will be touting their eggs on her stupid website, where she's wearing evening gowns while walking around her mansion that we're supposed to feel sorry for her because she's in. I love it. But on the grifter subject, one of the funniest things, that was Bill Simmons who said that at Spotify, I've never seen such a pair of grifters. They wouldn't do any work. She got paid all this money. She barely did anything. Him too.
Yeah.
And now she signs this pod deal with this Lemonada. We're not getting a podcast for years. And then she decides to sign this deal with Netflix. She's done nothing other than now this show she's going to do on cooking and friendship. Finally, okay, we'll believe it when we see it. And then finally, she's got her little Riviera thing going, where so far we've had one jar of strawberry jam.
It's been the whole thing. It's sort of lazy and a bit pathetic. You know, this is somebody who demands that we use the title Duchess of Sussex. I come from Sussex, which is a county in the south of England. I've spent more time in Sussex in the last month than Meghan Markle has spent in her entire life. She has no actual right.
She's your ruler, Piers. I didn't know that.
She ain't my ruler, Meghan Kelly. She is somebody who, listen, as I've said to you, I think many times before, if they actually want to do this kind of thing and trade themselves around as sort of, you know, celebrities and do that sort of circus, then they can do it, but they can't do it with the royal titles. They shouldn't be using the royal titles of Duke and Duchess of Sussex, bestowed on them by the monarchy, an institution they constantly complain about and trash whenever they get the chance. Fine, if you want to go off and be celebrities in California, do it, but don't trade on the titles. Every time I see her demanding to be called Duchess of Sussex, I laugh. Nobody in Britain calls her that. Meghan Markle, you know, she got lucky, met her prince, dragged him out of the bosom of his family, dragged him away from the monarchy, which bestowed those titles on them, and has now ruthlessly with him exploited those titles for massive personal gain. And I think it's disgusting and hypocritical. They shouldn't be allowed to do it. I hope that King Charles, who obviously is massively distracted by his illness, but I hope that King Charles at some stage just has that conversation and says, you can't keep the titles, I'm sorry, but you can't keep demeaning the status of being a member of the royal family and attacking the family and the monarchy and retain your titles. You can just be Harry and Meghan and see how you get on, by the way, when you're no longer royals, because the answer is not very far.
In the video we're going to show you here, Yale students formed a human chain to block a Jewish student from entering the university. Like, I can't believe this is happening in America. Watch this.
You're literally tapping us. I'm allowed to walk.
Let me walk around.
You can walk to us.
We're here.
Don't get in my way.
He's allowed
to. All right, so it looks to me like a conservative Jewish person. He's obviously openly Jewish, and they're not letting him pass. The mob follows him. He moves left, they move left. He moves right, they move right. As a swarm, and they're not letting him. This is America. This cannot happen at Yale University. Didn't you go there, Eliana?
I'm a 2006 graduate, and the Beacon also had a reporter up there covering the events as they transpired on Friday and Saturday, where just much like at Columbia, the students were camped out in tents on a university plaza. And it is noteworthy that these events took place at a World War II memorial to Yale students who served in the wars and tore down an American flag and cheered as it was brought to the ground at that memorial.
We actually have that. Here's a bit of it. SOT 7.
Viva, viva Palestina!
Tearing down the American flag. That's what they're cheering at, folks. I'm sorry, but that weird, like, it's like a part of the call to prayer, that sound. I've heard it in too many terror videos. It still brings a chill when I hear it. It's alarming. And to see it, to hear it yelled when an American flag falls on one of our most prestigious, or at least used to be, university campuses, Eliana, brings up something vile. I mean, I recoil. I can't believe this is not free speech. This is not about free speech. These people are calling for the death of Jews. They're tearing down American flags on American university colleges. And we're just sitting back saying, you Jews, go ahead, Eliana. Sure, you'd feel perfectly comfortable going to class and crossing their little picket line as the mob swarms in front of you, tearing down a flag, our flag, to say, no, try it. We dare you.
Yeah, at a memorial for young men who went and fought and died fighting the Nazis. It's insane, and it's noteworthy that administrators issued warnings on Saturday but did nothing. And at late Saturday evening, a young Jewish student, a young woman, was sent to the hospital when one of these protesters poked her in the eye with a Palestinian flag. And this morning, the police were called in to start arresting people. It must be. Yale University's president, Peter Salovey, announced a year ago that this would be his last year. They are looking for a new president. And so I think that has motivated him to take a more hands-off approach. This is not his problem. It's the next person's problem. However, he must be watching what is taking place on the Columbia University campus and thought, I've got to start clearing this out. But if these guys don't know already that the response to this is not to issue warnings and stand by as people start to get hurt, as private property, private university property is desecrated, rules are broken, university entrances and exits are blocked from students, warnings are not enough. Time to start calling the cops. I listened to a recording that we were not authorized to share that a student took of her call to the Yale University Police Department, where the police officers told her, we are concerned. We have not been authorized by the university to do anything yet. That obviously changed overnight, but 48 hours this went on. Students were hurt. Property was desecrated. People were not allowed to pass freely through campus. Enough is enough. You know, you don't have a right to attend Yale University. Time to students to be expelled.
Yeah, Honestly, I would expel them and I would do whatever I had to do to get them off campus, whether it's cops, National Guard. We have to get dramatic. This cannot be allowed. This is not about free speech. You know where you can go have perfect free speech rights? Out in the town square. Emily, you mentioned it earlier. Free speech is important. Yes, no one's saying they're not allowed to scream this hateful shit. That is the glory of being an American. You can scream hateful shit unless it amounts to incitement. But you have limited free speech rights when it comes to the center of the campus square. And this has gone beyond that menacing that they're doing to the Jewish student that we just showed there. That's illegal. You can't do that. That is not okay wherever you are. And it's certainly not okay on a college campus. I don't like when, and no, you weren't doing this, but when people try to reduce this kind of behavior to free speech, it's bullshit. That's not what this is. So we need to be really clear on acceptable behaviors. And all you need to do is picture a bunch of whites doing this to a black student about 40 years ago and ask yourself whether you defend it.
A reporter got kind of trolled on Twitter over the weekend. I want to say she was from the New York Times or the Washington Post for saying she was there and what she saw at Columbia was, you know, a lot of that crazy
stuff. Karen Atiyah. She's the one who blocked me. I used to follow her and then she cheered, "This is what resistance looks like," after a bunch of Israel babies and women and children were murdered. And I was like, okay, it's over between the two of us. But she's out there. So she's a Washington Post columnist who is out there. Hold on, I pulled it. Oh, here it is. Okay, just to add to what you're saying, and then I'll give you back the floor. I teach my last class of the semester at Columbia this coming week. God help them. That explains a lot. And the university has made this situation into a war zone. Well, so far we agree, but we disagree on how. It's by them permitting these protests in the first place. No, she says, most of the people posting about Columbia have not stepped foot on campus and have no idea what's going on. As I said, the demonstrations I saw last week were comprised of students of all faiths and backgrounds. Columbia escalated the situation by calling in armed police. The ones I saw, Hitler's always been very nice to me, Emily. All I saw was a perfect gentleman who was a very talented public speaker. That's what she's doing here. I didn't see any problems. Oh, then none must have existed, Karen.
Well, it's insane to put the burden just on the university for the actions of the students. I mean, I agree. Like, I think we all agree the university is doing too little. So, yes, she's right on that point. I guess she wants the university to do too much. But like, some of this is the university's fault. But you're seeing so little of people holding people who are organizing these protests, people who are, you know, peacefully participating in legitimate civil disobedience. They are not being asked to take control of the situation, because to the extent that Karen Atiyah is allowed to teach whatever nonsense she's teaching in that class, clearly Columbia University is letting people make these arguments, these ridiculous arguments that Hamas is the resistance, something Judith Butler has said before as well. Clearly those arguments are happening just fine. In fact, they're being facilitated and encouraged by these universities. And, you know, I think those arguments are ridiculous and wrong, but universities are obviously teaching them, but nobody is saying to the students that are organizing these protests, the burden is on you to reel back the violence, the calls for Israel to die, the people holding signs that say Al-Qassam's next target pointing at Jewish students. If you organize a protest, you should be held to account when things get out of control. How many times have we heard this exact same argument made about people on January 6th? You know, where they point the finger at Donald Trump, even though he said, go protest peacefully. And I think to some extent that's reasonable, but it's the same thing. But there's nothing in this case. Nobody is saying, hey, those students that are organizing this, they really need to step up and tell those other people to cut it out, because they don't, in some cases, want those people to cut it out.
No, God, they're leading them. I mean, I think we could all agree if they were having a protest on campus or even a sit-in, if it weren't, you know, incredibly disruptive and, you know, that's really the test, disruption under Supreme Court precedent. But if they were having a protest and chanting something like Israel's committing genocide, okay, that's an opinion. Many people have it. That is an okay, but threats against Jewish students are not okay on a college campus. That's just crossing a line that they would never allow anyone else to cross. And it's insane that these Jewish families now have to worry about these schools at which they spend almost $70,000 a year in tuition, I think it is, $67,000, I think, for Columbia now, that last check. I've got to talk to you about Ilhan Omar's daughter, Eliana, because she's made herself a public face of these protests. You're shocked. Shocked, I know. And she's at Barnard, which is right next to Columbia, and is participating in this sit-in, this nonstop, off again, on again, I guess is a more accurate term, but pernicious sit-in. And she, along with the other students who were not complying with the police directives and so on, came out, got the full Vogue. Is it Teen Vogue treatment?
It's always Teen Vogue.
It's always Teen Vogue. And look, here she is. She's such a hero. The headline, Isra Hirsi, Ilhan Omar's daughter, on Columbia arrests, Barnard suspension, Palestine protests. The subtitle is, the longtime social justice activist and Barnard Jr., 21, talks to Teen Vogue about the 48 hours following Columbia University's decision to send NYPD into a campus Palestine solidarity encampment. That's not exactly how it went down. But she decides to paint her time there as like she was basically just kicked out of the last homeless shelter in New York with no food and no roof over her head, and says as follows. We were reading our email and it said we had 15 minutes to go get our shit if we wanted it. And we'd have to go with a public safety escort. I was like, I'm not going to do that. But I was a little frantic, like, where am I going to sleep? Where am I gonna go? And also, all of my shit is thrown into a random lot. It's pretty horrible. I don't know when I can go home, and I don't know if I ever will be able to. I mean, could you spare me? I've only got crocodile tears for this person who was out there leading all this shit. And then to double down, she goes, of course, on MSNBC. And listen to this. Now, I want the audience to pay particular attention to something we discussed last week, which is her reference to the alleged chemical weapons that she claims were deployed against her. We know the truth thanks to the Free Beacon, Eliana's publication. Listen.
Do you feel that you are being targeted because of the fact that it is in solidarity with Palestinians and against what Israel is doing to Palestinians?
Oh, this is 100% targeted. Every single protest that we have, there's a group of counter-protesters that bring all of their items, their flags and things like that. And they're not seen as having unsanctioned protests or really receive the kind of disciplinary warnings that many of our fellow organizers receive just for being seen at these protests. And so there is definitely some hypocrisy here, especially you can kind of see it with the students that were sprayed us with the chemical weapons, and the fact that there's no public information as to what happened to them, but rather the university is actively discussing what is happening to the students here and making it a whole public spectacle rather than when we haven't done anything to physically harm students, whereas those that sprayed those chemical weapons physically harmed students.
Care to comment on that, Eliana?
Let's just start with the facts. The chemical weapon in question was a fart spray purchased on Amazon for $26 called Liquid Ass. Okay. And
I have that New York IDF State Supreme tool in the Trump trial too.
Yeah. She says nothing happened to these students. These students who sprayed that were suspended, which is why they are now suing Columbia University for accusing them of spraying a chemical weapon. They were suspended immediately. Columbia president Manoush Shafiq testified before the Columbia University Senate and said that these students had used chemical weapons. These students were former IDF soldiers and then came to Columbia. So she spread this misinformation, and the fact that this was not any kind of chemical weapon, but in fact, this harmless fart spray purchased off Amazon, surfaced in their lawsuit where they are litigating their suspension. So what she said, that we can't protest, but they can and nothing happens to them, is total and utter bullshit.
She's on MSNBC and got a spread in Teen Vogue. They got suspended and she got slaughtered on SNBC.
Our protests appear to violate the policies. Either the protests violate the policies or they do not. Her protests, her behavior violated the university policy. Beyond that, her mother, apple doesn't fall far from the tree, was questioning the Columbia University president, weighing in on behalf of the protesters, and never disclosed to the American public that her daughter is one of the protesters who's going to suffer the consequences. One would think, at least in the interests of propriety, that Representative Omar would say, you know, my daughter's on the campus and she's one of these agitators. And no. She didn't say a word about that. In the interest, Omar was actually the one who got Columbia President Shafiq to say there are no anti-Jewish protests that I've seen and allowed representatives.
She was the one who asked the question.
Have there been anti-Muslim protests? Shafiq said no. She said, have there been anti-Jewish protests? Shafiq said no. And then Elise Stefanik stepped in and said, I'm sorry. That there have been no anti-Jewish protests. Would you consider death to Zionists? Is that anti-Jewish? And Shafiq had to backpedal and say,
death to Jews.
They weren't labeled anti-Jewish. Like when the notice that they were happening went out, they just, evolved in that. They just evolved in that direction. And then her three co-panelists, the chairman of the board of trustees, Jay Carney's wife, Claire Shipman, and David Schizer, whatever his name is, they all contradicted her and said, of course, there have been anti-Jewish protests on this campus. What she said is a total and utter lie.
I think we're being too hard on Ilhan Omar's daughter, who, let's face it, for a brief period of time, her uncle became her stepdad when her mom married her brother. So it's, that kind of stuff can cause lasting damage, which can manifest itself in a number of ways, Emily. I'll tell you why the campus cops are not throwing the Israeli protesters off campus. It's pretty clear. It's depicted, for example, in this soundbite from Columbia with the Jewish students sought for. They're singing. They're waving American flags and Israeli flags.
They're not covering their face.
No face is covered. This is why they don't get bothered, Emily. They're not doing anything. And I realize Israel right now is in the midst of a bombing campaign against a group that attacked it viciously on 10/7, which is controversial. But these students are getting protested. These Americans are getting harassed. It's been amazing to me to watch since 10/7, some of these liberal Jewish Americans have the light bulb go off on top of their head. I'm thinking of, for example, Bill Ackman, right? This billionaire investor, and he's been very outspoken about now DEI on college campuses. And I appreciate people like Bill Ackman, who's got power and influence and a lot of money, joining the fight. But there are many who have been fighting this with every fiber of their being for years, like you, hello, and have been called every name in the book without any support from people like Bill. And it's like a great, pick up arms, rhetorical arms, and fight right alongside of us. But some humility for the fact that you missed it all while it was happening, in my view, is in order.
Absolutely. And again, the Jewish donors that have finally woken up, don't let it end here. Don't be bought off with, we're going to add anti-Semitism training to the portfolio of DEI. That was Bill Ackman's original proposal when this all started. And he said he was so shocked that Jews weren't included in the marginalized groups of against the majority on campus, as if the majority, there is no majority on campus. The one victimized group that's on campus these days is heterosexual white males. They are screwed. They are the last to be hired, the last to be admitted. They have to be three times as good. Of course, the Asians have to be 10 times as good as anybody else. But if you're a heterosexual white male, forget it. It's over for you. But Ackman's initial position was, the Jews are oppressed by this somehow phantom white WASP majority. he gave that up. There's still a lot of people holding on to that. And it's frankly hilarious. I mean, these protest signs of Queers for Palestine just shows how fundamentally ignorant Americans are about the world. They live in a bubble of victimhood, so they apparently don't even know how people in Muslim countries or in the Middle East, Muslim Middle Easterners, treat queers. Good luck holding a gay pride march in Gaza or on the West Bank. Good luck doing that in Nairobi. Good luck doing that in Africa. So the intersectional coalition is now, it's holding together fine, except for Jews. And of course, Jews should be really kind of miffed about this. They were essential to the civil rights movement. They were essential to the anti-apartheid movement. And Blacks are screwing them over. You have South Africa dragging Israel into the world court for genocide, which is a preposterous claim. And you have the majority Black politicians now siding with their Palestinian brothers in victimhood. This is ridiculous. And claiming that Jews are somehow the main threat to Blacks and to Palestinians, all of this is complete fiction. So this, again, should be a movement to basically shut down as much of the universities as we can, create as many alternatives as we can, and for people to speak up for Western civilization, which has given us the very foundational ideas that the left uses against the West: equality, tolerance, human rights, limited government. These are all exclusively Western ideas. They came out of no place outside of the West. They didn't come out of Africa. They didn't come out of China. They didn't come out of Arabia. They didn't come out of India. And now the left uses the bounty of beautiful Enlightenment ideas to try and tear down the Enlightenment. There is something sick in the West right now. We are a self-canceling culture. The great replacement theory is real. I've decided to destroy our birthrate and to flood our country with cultures that en masse are not compatible. We cannot assimilate the number of people who are coming, and we've decided we don't even want to try. And of course, the most galling thing, Megan, is that the left in the morning says the US and Europe are the most oppressive places on earth. They are fundamentally hostile to people of color. Their grounding ideology is one of white supremacy. That's their line in the morning. And in the afternoon, they say, any country that does not have open borders, any Western country does not have open borders to allow as many millions of people want to come from third world places of color, that the West is then oppressive. You can't have it both ways. You can't say that the West is endemically lethal to people of color and at the same time say we want as many people of color to come in illegally into Western countries as possible, because that's where their lives will be improved. It's make so up true. Your mind. You get one or the other. You either say the West is racist, or you get to say everybody comes in. You can't say both.
That's right. Or as they now put it, it's not safe for brown and black bodies. It's not safe for brown
exactly.
and black bodies.
This
discussion is reminding me of a couple of headlines I retweeted today from the Babylon Bee, which is always great in these situations. Here's one. Columbia protesters clarify they only want death to America after America is done paying their student loans off. Yes, exactly right. Here's another one. Palestine protester tries to argue with skinhead, but they just agree on everything. That's right. The Jews are bad. Yeah, same. I feel the same. And then there's Columbia student leaves lecture on microaggressions to attend Kill the Jews rally.
Well, you know, again, it's all continuous. If you feel like you are the victim of microaggressions on campus, and that claim of victimhood has catapulted you to the top of the victim totem pole, you have a lot of power and you get drunk with power. And you know, you started, Megan, with the Columbia administrators sort of tiptoeing around the tents and saying, well, we're going to give you another 48 hours. That's because at the same time as we have this profoundly radical and hate-filled ideology of sort of make-believe radicalism and Marxism on college campuses, you have at the same time the very epitome of a capitalist ideology, which is the student as consumer, and adults creating the, you know, the climbing walls and the Starbucks cafes at every corner on college campuses, and redoing the dormitories to have every amenity. You know, I visited Yale several years ago, and in the Berkeley dining hall, they had tastings of different extra virgin olive oils from Italy. And at the same time, you know, the Yale students, the minority students, are out there claiming that they're so victimized, they're throwing tantrums against the renowned sociologist Nicholas Christakis, telling him to shut up, and, you know, who the fuck invited you? Because we as Black students are so victimized in college campuses. At the same time, they have olive oil, virgin olive oil tastings. It's a profoundly decadent environment that is about anything but knowledge. These students should be down on their knees in gratitude. Yeah.
Here's the New York Post on what we're seeing at your alma mater, Yale, where you went undergrad. Decrying capitalism while munching on fresh sushi Monday. Yep. While supposedly, by the way, engaging in a week-long hunger strike. So, okay, pick a lane. And then they go on to write, but the festive atmosphere continued even after some were arrested, as some protesters paired off to do some salsa dancing, wide smiles plastered on their faces as they took a well-deserved break from denouncing free enterprise and their university $85,000 a year to attend.
Where do you begin? I mean, these are the most spoiled people in human history. You know, we thought that the monarchy was bad. I'm not actually would have been in favor of it. I think authority is great. You know, they were great artistic patrons. I love the Habsburg Empire. I'm in Vienna, and I love they supported a style of music, of architecture that is unparalleled in its beauty. But you know, we think, oh, those spoiled kings and aristocrats that lived off everybody else. These students are living off of everybody else. They are completely self-involved. They have no idea what it took to create the prosperity that they take for granted. Every fabric, every material around you was the product of this extraordinary 400-year race to create knowledge, to transform human existence from what was millennia of the most squalid, disease-filled, poverty-stricken, famine-stricken existence where you barely eked out, to now our problem is obesity. We're so successful. Capitalism, free market economy has been so successful that we are drowning in goods. We are drowning in prosperity, and we have no recollection. We have no knowledge of what it took. And meanwhile, we're tearing down science by saying if any standard of excellence has a disparate impact on Black and Hispanic students, we should tear it down. We should get rid of credentializing in medicine. We should credentialize on the basis of race, not knowledge of medicine. We should hire and promote on the basis of race, not knowledge of how to save a cancer victim or how to solve a heart attack victim. The federal government under Biden is handing out billions of dollars of federal taxpayer money based not on who is the best oncologist or who is the best neurologist to try and cure Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease, but who has the darkest skin color. But of course, if you're East Asian, that doesn't count. Or if you're an Indian, that doesn't count. In fact, our science profession right now is extraordinarily multinational, multicultural, multiracial. The only groups who are not proportionally represented are Blacks and Hispanics. And that's not because of racism. It's because of the skills gap. It's because the grasp of math and science concepts is so low. That's a problem that begins in the family. It begins in a culture of anti-academic achievement. It begins in stigmatizing academic effort as acting white. That's what has to change. we should not be tearing down our standards, Megan, but we are a culture now that is engaged in self-loathing. And when the West tears itself down, there's going to be nothing left. The mob can destroy, it cannot create. And we'll see what happens if the West continuously self-cancels. China will take over. I mean, they are now beating us in many types of nanotechnologies because they do care about merit. They're not handing scientific and math privileges out based on identity politics. They're saying, I'm going to find the best math talent among the student body, and I'm going to throw everything we've got. Meanwhile, America is tearing down gifted and talented programs because of the usual race issue, and we're tearing down our criminal law enforcement because of the usual race issue. This is how a society destroys excellence and civilization.
They've been using the term Selma envy to describe a lot of these students, right? They're just so desperate
to be
part of something that matters, and they missed that particular movement. And so now they're finding something else and falsely trying to compare themselves to people who actually did suffer and didn't endure a lot in order to change this country by claiming they're on a hunger strike when really they're ordering sushi to their George Soros-funded tent, by claiming, you know, woe is me while they're sneaking off for a little salsa dancing, by, as Ilhan Omar's daughter who went to Barnard, she goes there now, was suspended in connection with one of these protests, calling herself now homeless because she got suspended temporarily, and saying she was the victim of a chemical weapons attack, Heather, because one of the students sprayed a gas, meaning fart spray, on campus that is non-toxic. It says so on the bottle. And she, without mentioning that's what happened, just goes on MSNBC and says, I was the victim of a chemical weapons attack. Sure, sure you were, Isla, or Isra, whatever her name is.
I mean, we're basically putting a target on our backs and saying, come and invade. I mean, this is such a decadent society. We do not have martial virtues anymore. I wish I could send these people into combat. Obviously, nobody wants to be at war, but these are people who are living a fiction and are completely soft. We have lost any sense of realism and martial virtues. It is completely pathetic, but it all comes to, I remember in the 1990s, you would have faculty writing op-eds in the New York Times saying, oh, where's the student protest? No, you know what? Here's the only thing you're obliged to do and should do on a college campus is learn, shut up and learn some history. Shut up and learn some chemistry. Shut up and learn some literature. Listen to Mozart, listen to Brahms, listen to Chopin, study Tiepolo, study John Milton, study the periodic table. You have 4 years to confront and absorb the greatness of people who went before you, who make you look like pygmies. You should really not be heard. We don't care what you think. Conservatives make the mistake of saying, oh, well, college is all about debate and free speech and critical thinking. Yeah, I'm a little less enamored of that concept. What it should be really about is cramming as much knowledge into the empty noggins of these pathetic crybabies as is possible in 4 years. And then if you want to go out after college and debate whether Trump is a fascist or how many sex organs we should lop off of adolescents today, that's fine. But right now, you should be devoted to one thing, and that is overcoming your embarrassing ignorance about the world and your place in it.
That is so well said. I've got to play this soundbite. I'm going to front it by telling you, I don't know exactly how he got it or whether he was there, but Rudy Giuliani posted it on X of a student and her friend who were at the NYU protest. And listen to this exchange, Heather.
And what would you say is the main goal with tonight's protest?
I think the goal is just showing our support for Palestine and demanding that NYU stops. I honestly don't know all of what NYU's doing.
Is there something that NYU's doing?
I really don't know. I'm pretty sure they're... Do you know what NYU is doing
about what?
About Israel. Why are we protesting here?
Palestine will be free.
I wish I was more educated.
I'm not either.
Yes, we all wish that.
I came from Colombia. I was there about Colombia, and we came down. They said NYU students needed our support. So I came down. I heard there's lots of cops. Some people were saying it was getting dangerous.
Heather.
It is so ridiculous. Again, it is coded. They're doing this because they're in a college campus and time is running out. The school year's ending. What will they do when they don't have the bureaucrats to go around handing them out little cookies and saying, well, we're going to negotiate. You can pretend like you're hostages and we're negotiating with you and you're in danger. They'll be thrown out into the real world and there'll be nobody to negotiate with. Now they've got this bunting. They're like little babies swaddled by all of the DEI bureaucrats and the student services bureaucrats and the vice presidents of first gen students. And it's a marvelous, they are codependent addicts. They're addicted to melodrama and to fiction because they are living in fictional worlds. They are not oppressed in America. They have more freedom than has ever been experienced in all of human history. And yet they live in a world that perversely celebrates victimhood. They, by self-acclamation, they know nothing. Let's give them a map with all of the countries' names wiped out. And let's see if they can even find Gaza on a map, much less Jordan, the Golan Heights, Syria, Iran. Cannot do it. This is completely as much of a social contagion as the trans thing is. It is adolescents striving to have power over adults, which is what every adult craves, whether it's claiming that you've been misgendered and so you can crush an adult under your thumb, or claiming that you are in solidarity with Palestine and therefore are yourself somehow a victim. It gives adolescents power, and that's what they crave.
I'm Megyn Kelly, host of The Megyn Kelly Show on Sirius XM. It's your home for open, honest, and provocative conversations with the most interesting and important political, legal, and cultural figures today. You can catch The Megyn Kelly Show on Triumph, a Sirius XM channel featuring lots of hosts you may know and probably love. Great people like Dr. Laura, Glenn Beck, Nancy Grace, Dave Ramsey, and yours truly, Megyn Kelly. You can stream The Megyn Kelly Show on Sirius XM at home or anywhere you are. No car required. I do it all the time. I love the Sirius XM app. It has ad-free music, coverage of every major sport, comedy, talk, podcast, and more. Subscribe now. Get your first 3 months for free.
Go to SiriusXM.com/MKShow to subscribe and get 3 months free. That's SiriusXM.com/MKShow and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.
There's another woman over there named Alex Wagner who was on the same panel making a similar point. I'll stick with you on this, Mike, about how they're trying to, quote, normalize NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, in this abominable Trump courtroom. All right, take a listen to her.
Number one, for all journalism students out there, checkbook journalism, not a thing. It is not a thing. The strategy from Trump's team, at least as I understood it today, seems to be to normalize outlandish things, which is the arguing that NDAs are just a common practice, that lots of wealthy people do them. This is nothing abnormal. Everybody has NDAs. You guys may not have heard about them before, but it happens. This is a thing that is done. Just because Trump had a bunch of people signing NDAs doesn't mean there's anything suspect about that. Catch and kill. It happens all the time. There's nothing illegal about this scheme. This sort of thing happens all the time. This is from Todd Blanche's mouth to the jury. And then my favorite, there is nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy. That is not how the world works.
There is so much to dissect there, Mike. I mean, NDAs. NBC is the king of NDAs, okay? Somebody in this discussion right here might have been forced to sign one. I have a list of women that's longer than Santa's scroll who have been forced to sign NDAs by NBC News and MSNBC, Alex. So you might want to do your homework before you bash them as a tool that's only used by people who are on criminal trial. Although on second thought, maybe NBC will be headed there someday and her remarks will prove true. But that's right. And the checkbook journal, like, this is not how how journalism is done. As I point out, this is how NBC News handled journalism when it came to its Pulitzer Prize winning story that it let walk out the door and go to The New Yorker. And not just that, Mike, but look at the number of stories that were manipulated, suppressed, buried, or promoted during the 2020 election. We could go back to 16 too for Hillary, but let's just stick with 2020 when it came to Trump v. Biden. To sell to a jury that only the Republican did this evil thing of manipulating the media is going to be very tough.
Yeah, I mean, I was a real lawyer in Colorado for 10 years before I got dragged back into D.C. and the political scene. And I'll tell you, NDAs, non-disclosure agreements, these payments, they happen every day in the legal practice. And just say that Trump is trying to normalize them shows that this young journalist is absolutely clueless and sanctimonious, or she's lying. So it's one of the two, because it's routine in the practice of law and the practice of politics and the practice of journalism that you use non-disclosure agreements and you have to make payments. You have to settle nuisance claims from time to time, actually quite frequently if you're a big target. You know, you can call it hush money, but it's the settlement of a nuisance claim with a non-disclosure agreement.
The other thing is, Dave, you know, the New York Post reporting on the Hunter Biden laptop was universally suppressed by the mainstream media. And we saw just 2 weeks ago an expose by an NPR insider saying they were intentionally keeping that out of the news at NPR because they knew that it would help Trump. And they openly said, no, this will help Trump. Okay, no cash exchanged hands, but it's in principle the same exact thing. A friendly media outlet that says, I want the election to turn out a certain way, and shapes its coverage accordingly.
Well, Megan, first off, you're right. NBC has treated me very well, so I'm not going to criticize them. Yeah. But you can see why the mainstream media is critical of a publication like the National Enquirer, who was actually working with Trump to try to help his election in this case. Now, you're bringing up the New York Post story, and I think actually it's fair to bring that up because you had the press who thought this was some Russian disinformation or something that was planted, and they stopped it. And in the end, we don't know exactly where it came from or what, but it's something that probably should have been out there and let the people decide. But yeah, I hear
I know
what
it came from. It came from Hunter to a legally blind repairman. Then Hunter never picked it up. And then a legally blind repairman called Rudy Giuliani. And by the way, the FBI had it too and verified that it was Hunter's.
Well, regardless, it is something I agree with you that should be out there, actually. And as far as NBC, they're the ones who are trying to point to this National Enquirer as what you should not do. And I agree with them because you don't engage with a presidential campaign to try to figure out a way to help them get elected and be used as a tool to buy a story and to kill it just to help a campaign. Can I go back to one thing real quick, Megan? I promise real quick,
yeah.
Because you said I was doing the gummies, but the reason why I talk about the statute of limitations issue, I just have to tell you, and Mike and I were talking off air, is because there is a provision of New York law that says that when you move away, like in the White House or Florida, the statute of limitations is paused for up to 5 years. So that's why I still believe that even if it's just misdemeanors, that prosecutors could still bring the case against Trump for falsification of business records. I was not smoking the peace pipe.
I don't think that virtually anybody else accepts that. And none of the legal experts I've been following in this believe that that would have resurrected this dead claim. But okay, point taken. No gummies involved.
Thank you.
I do want to, let's see, hold on a second. I want to make sure I've gotten everything here. Oh, okay. This last question on the Trump trial. We had the ruling yesterday morning that virtually everything Trump has ever done is going to come in against him if he gets cross-examined. And we've been talking about this issue in New York State in connection with my pal Arthur Idala, who represents, speaking of Harvey Weinstein, he represents Harvey Weinstein. And he just had an argument before the New York State Court of Appeals, our highest court, saying you made it impossible for him to take the stand in his own defense by saying, like, every woman he ever, you know, interacted with or had a complaint about him was going to be allowed to take the stand against him. And like the prior bad acts evidence would have been so overwhelming, it would have absolutely ensured a conviction. And the ones they even allowed, even without him testifying, was very lengthy. It was a lengthy list. So Trump is kind of facing the same thing, where they had a hearing and they said, if he takes a stand, it's going to be a lot of bad things we're going to let in. And this is where Andy McCarthy, he had a piece on this today. The lawfare against Trump, Dave, that's already gone down, is really coming back to haunt him, because the judge is going to let in the Letitia James, you know, $450 million judgment against him. Fraud, corporate fraud. The case against Weisselberg, his top financial guy, who was found guilty of a criminal violation. Another fraudster. The fact that he defamed E. Jean Carroll, but not the fact that he allegedly sexually assaulted her. You know, a liar. He's a liar. And on it goes. So, like, it's almost as if the Democrats have been laying the foundation for all of this to support a criminal conviction in this flimsy case all along. And so you tell me whether there's any chance, given the judge's ruling, all that can come in, that Trump will take the stand.
Megan, he was never going to take the stand. It would have been walking into a perjury trap. He'd have embarrassing details of his relationship with Stormy Daniels. And yes, prior bad acts can come in up to the judge's discretion. He allowed some, not others. He allowed talking about the Access Hollywood tape, but not the playing of the Access Hollywood tape. I thought he was pretty fair in his rulings, but I think this is all for naught. I mean, look, it's like asking me, what teams do you want to play for in the NBA? Like, I'm never going to play in the NBA. Donald Trump was never going to take the stand in his defense. This is something he's done in the past. He said, I'm going to take the stand, you know, in the E. Jean Carroll case, and didn't. I'm going to talk to Robert Mueller in the investigation, and he didn't. I'm going to take the stand in the civil fraud case, and he didn't. So that's just bluster. He was never going to take the stand in his defense.
He took it in the second E. Jean case. That was one he did take it in. I don't think you should take the stand at all, Mike. Do you?
I wouldn't in this case. I mean, I would say that Trump is different from other criminal defendants. If you're a criminal defense attorney, you generally would advise most of your clients not to take the stand. I would say that with President Trump in some of these matters, that, you know, he should be out there, maybe not taking the stand, but he should be out there making public statements to defend himself against this lawfare and election interference. But I don't think he should take the stand in this case. There's little upside and there's a lot of downside, as you just laid out. And this process is so clearly rigged against them. Do not give them any rope to hang you.
Okay. One other story, and then I want to get to these college protests. But before we get to the college protests, we got to talk about Alec Baldwin. Did you guys see this viral video of him? I have to say, I'm not, you know, whatever. Alec Baldwin's got a temper, and he's obviously in a lot of trouble right now out in New Mexico because of the death of this cinematographer on his movie set. But I am 100% team Alec Baldwin when it comes to what just happened to him here. Here's the video for those of you who haven't seen it.
Alec, can you please say Free Palestine one time? Why did you kill that lady? You killed that lady and got no jail time? No jail time, Alec? No jail time, Alec. You're putting innocent people in jail, Alec Baldwin. Free Palestine, Alec, just one time, and I'll leave you alone. I'll leave you alone, I swear. Just say Free Palestine one time. One time. One time.
Call the police.
One time, Alec. You know he's a criminal. You know he's a fucking criminal. Come on, Alec. Just say Free Palestine one time. One time. Just one time. Please. And I'll leave you alone. Free Palestine. Fuck Israel. Fuck Zionism. Please say it. One time.
And then he gets her with his left hand, clearly grabs the camera or knocks it out of her hand. And she goes by Crackhead Barney. So Crackhead got into an altercation with him and tweeted out that this white devil assaulted me. Dave, you're a prosecutor. If Crackhead came to you and said, I want to file charges against Alec Baldwin for assault, what would you do?
No file, and here's why. She can go to police and she can fill out a complaint, and this could be technically a battery because it's an unwanted touching. It's a very low bar. You have to just have probable cause. But then it would come to my office as prosecutor. And the question is, could I prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt? There is not a jury in the United States that would find Alec Baldwin guilty. When Megyn Kelly is standing up for Alec Baldwin, you know there's not a jury in the world that would side with crackhead, whatever her name is. And, you know, this shows you the problems with this pro-Hamas, pro-Palestinian movement that she's a part of. Number one, they're the ones engaging in bullying and harassment. You can just see it for your own eyes. Number two, their whole philosophy is based on ignorance. They don't know anything about what's going on in Gaza. They just discovered Gaza just a few months ago. This is just exactly a trendy right. thing. Yeah, it's a trendy thing for them to get on board. And lastly, there's no self-awareness here. I mean, she actually portrays herself as the victim. Meanwhile, Baldwin is opening the door, asking her politely to please leave. And she's the one who thinks she's the victim. This is why they're losing support for people who see things like this. This is why even you, Megyn Kelly, come to the defense of Alec Baldwin, and justifiably so.
Thanks for listening to The Megyn Kelly Show. No BS, no agenda, and no fear.